It is unlikely she went to Iraq with a dog leash in her duty bag. However, all that was necessary for social facilitation to take over was for any official to give the MPs permission to take even one such photo of abuse. That permission opened the doors to this new nightly activity of ever more scenes of creative evil at work. Once started, there was no end in sight, because it was relieving the MPs' boredom, getting revenge, demonstrating mastery, and having fun and sex games, until Joe Darby blew the whistle and shut down the show. Abu Ghraib Photos. Comparative literature professor Judith Butler invites us to reconsider the significance of the Abu Ghraib photographs not as coming from the whims of the particular MPs taking them. Rather, she argues that the MPs were embedded photographers whose images reflected the basic values of their military: homophobia, misogyny, and dominance over all enemies. Gaining status, getting revenge. Let's acknowledge the generally low status of Army reservists within the military hierarchy, which was further degrading for a reservist MP assigned to the night shift in a horrible prison. They realized that they were at the bottom of the barrel, working under awful conditions, taking orders from civilians, and without recourse to authorities who cared enough to check out what was going on there. The only ones on the scene with lower status were the prisoners themselves. Therefore, the nature of the abuses, as well as their documentation, served to establish the unequivocal social dominance of every guard over all of their prisoners through this downward comparison. The torture and abuse were an exercise of pure power for the sake of demonstrating their absolute control over their inferiors. The photos were needed by some of these guards to convince themselves of their superiority, as well as to broadcast their dominant status to their peers. The photos gave them bragging rights. It is also likely that racism was involved, to some extent, with generally negative attitudes toward Arabs as a very different other. This was a carryover of hostility from the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks against all brown-skinned men of any Arabic background. A more immediate motive shared by many soldiers was revenge for fellow soldiers who had been killed or seriously wounded by Iraqi insurgents. It is apparent that revenge led to retaliation against inmates who had rioted or who had allegedly raped a boy. For example, the seven prisoners arrayed in the pyramid had been sent to Tier 1A after rioting in Camp Gansey and hurting a female MP in the process. Humiliating and beating them up was teaching them a lesson about the consequences of getting out of control. For instance, the only prisoner Chip Frederick ever hit was the one he punched hard in the chest because he allegedly threw a rock that hurt the female MP. Forcing detainees to simulate fellatio or to masturbate in public in front of women soldiers and then documenting this humiliation was more than just a tactic of embarrassment. It was the MP's sexual scenarios as payback for detainees they felt had gone over the line. De-individuation and the Mardi Gras effect. Nevertheless, how do we account for Lindy England's conception that it was all just fun and games? In this case, I believe de-individuation is involved. The anonymity of person and place that we noted earlier can create an altered state of mind which, when combined with diffused responsibility for one's actions, induces de-individuation. Actors become immersed in their high-intensity physical actions without rational planning or regard for consequences. The past and future give way to an immediate, present, hedonistic time perspective. It is a mind space in which emotion rules reason, and constraints on passion are loosened. It is the Mardi Gras effect of living for the moment behind a mask that conceals one's identity and gives vent to libidinous, violent, and selfish impulses that are ordinarily contained. Behavior then erupts in response to immediate situational demands, without planned conspiracy or malicious forethought. We saw what happened when this Lord of the Flies phenomenon was brought into my NYU laboratory, as de-individuated women gave ever-increasing shocks to innocent victims. It was also recreated by some of the guards in our Stanford prison. In these situations, as in Abu Ghraib, standard social constraints against aggression and antisocial action were suspended as people experienced extended latitudes of behavioral freedom. Just as I did not encourage my guards to act sadistically, neither did the military encourage its guards to engage in sexual abuse against prisoners. Nevertheless, in both situations, a general norm of permissiveness prevailed that created a sense that the guards could do pretty much whatever they felt like doing because they were not personally accountable and could get away with anything because no one was watching. In that context, traditional moral reasoning is diminished. Actions speak louder than old learned lessons, and Dionysian impulses suppress Apollonian rationality. Moral disengagement operated then to change the mental and emotional landscape of those caught up in its web. Comparable abuses by British and elite U.S. soldiers. If the social psychological principles that I argue were operating on that Tier 1A night shift are not person-specific, but situation-specific, we should find similar abuses in other similar settings perpetrated by very different soldiers in that same combat zone. Indeed, there are at least two verified instances of such behavior, both of which were hardly noticed by the U.S. media. British soldiers stationed at the Basra prison in Iraq also sexually abused their captives, forcing them to simulate sodomy on each other after stripping them naked. Their photos shocked the British public, who could not believe that their young man would ever do such terrible deeds, and then even document them. The fact that one of the abusers was a decorated hero from earlier combat was an even greater violation of the British public's expectations. Even worse, and more to the point, was what BBC News reported on June 29, 2004. UK troops swapped abuse photos. The subtitle added, "British soldiers have swapped hundreds of photos showing brutality against Iraqi captives." Several soldiers who were serving as members of the elite Queen's Lancashire Regiment gave some of the images to the Daily Mirror, one of which showed a hooded prisoner being struck with a rifle butt, urinated on, and with a gun held to his head. The soldiers claimed that there were many more pictures of such abuse that they shared in a culture of trading pictures. However, their army commanders destroyed them when they were found in their luggage as they were leaving Iraq. On the May 12, 2004 edition of 60 Minutes 2, CBS's Dan Rather ran a home video made by an American soldier that revealed what conditions were like at both Camp Buka and Abu Ghraib. The video segment shows a young soldier's disdain for the Iraqi prisoners. She says, "We've already had two prisoners die, but who cares? That's two less for me to worry about." Several other soldiers who were at Camp Buka and are accused of abusing prisoners there told Rather that the problems began with the chain of command, the same chain of command that was in charge of Abu Ghraib when the pictures of torture and abuse were taken. Another documented instance of this loss of control involved U.S. soldiers from the 82nd Airborne Division who were stationed at the Forward Operating Base, FOB, Mercury, near Fallujah. It was the place where insurgents and other captives were temporarily imprisoned before being shipped off to Abu Ghraib. "The murderous maniacs" is what they, Fallujah citizens, called us, because they knew that if they got caught by us and detained by us before they went to Abu Ghraib, then it would be hell to pay. This sergeant's account goes on to describe how they would fuck a PUC, person under control, by beating him or torturing him severely. He goes on to report that everyone in camp knew if you wanted to work out your frustration, you show up at the PUC tent. In a way, it was sport. Another sergeant from the same unit elaborated on his motives for the abuse, which included breaking detainees' legs with a metal baseball bat. Some days we would get bored, so we would have everyone sit in a corner and then make them get into a pyramid. This was before Abu Ghraib, but just like it. We did it for amusement. Army Captain Ian Fishback, an officer in this elite unit, also testified to Human Rights Watch in September 2005 about the extensive prisoner abuse that was going on in that prison setting. He revealed that his soldiers had also documented their terrible deeds in digital images. At FOB Mercury, they said that they had pictures that were similar to what happened at Abu Ghraib, and because they were so similar to what happened at Abu Ghraib, the soldiers destroyed the pictures. They burned them. The exact quote was, "They, the soldiers at Abu Ghraib, were getting in trouble for the same things we were told to do, so we destroyed the pictures." We will meet the captain again in the next chapter, where his detailed description of the abuses perpetrated by his unit matches those in Tier 1A, with the exception of the sexual abuse. Putting Sergeant Ivan Frederick on trial. The team of military investigators and prosecutors invested considerable zeal in preparing the cases against each of the seven accused MPs. Had the military command responsible for Abu Ghraib invested a fraction of that attention, concern, and resources in oversight and maintenance of discipline, there would have been no need for these trials. Their game plan was simple and compelling. After gathering sufficient evidence and testimonies, they worked out plea bargain deals with each of the defendants, whereby the most extreme sentences possible would be reduced if they pled guilty and testified against their fellow MPs. The trials began with those most minimally involved, such as Specialist Jeremy Civitz, to give it up on each of the others, working up to the big three, Frederick, Grainer, and England. Five charges were leveled against Frederick. In a stipulation of fact, as part of his plea bargain, the accused accepted them as true, susceptible to proof, and also admissible in evidence. Conspiracy to maltreat detainees. Conspiracy charges are usually difficult to prove in civilian courts without hard evidence, in writing or in audio or videotape of the planning. However, in this case, the MP's conspiracy consisted of entering into a nonverbal agreement with other MPs on Tier 1A of the hard site. That means a wordless conspiracy existed among the accused and with Davis, Grainer, Ambule, Harmon, Civitz, and England. They are alleged to have agreed as a group to engage in specific acts which served to maltreat detainees, subordinates, which is a violation of Article 93 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Stipulation of Fact, page 3. Does that mean by a wink and a nod or hand gestures? Alternatively, does it mean that they engaged in these documented activities in concert, and therefore, in retrospect, there must have been an a priori conspiracy? Dereliction of duty. As the non-commissioned officer in charge, Frederick had a duty to treat all detainees with dignity and respect and to protect detainees and prisoners in his presence from illegal abuse, cruelty, and maltreatment. Stipulation of Fact, page 6. He was derelict in all these duties. Maltreatment of detainees. This refers to the hooded prisoner with electrodes attached to his fingers, who was led to believe that if he fell off the box he was forced to stand on, he would be electrocuted. Frederick attached one of those wires to the prisoner's left hand and took a photo of it as a souvenir. Also mentioned in this charge as background is the reason that this detainee, nicknamed Gilligan, was made to stand on the box for long periods in a stress position. He was being kept awake as part of a sleep management program. Sleep management normally includes rigorous physical exercise to keep a detainee awake before being interrogated. Stipulation of Fact, page 6. There are other specifications of maltreatment of several detainees in the human pyramid, and putting a detainee, nicknamed Shitboy, because he covered himself with feces, between two medical litters in an attempt to get him to stop defecating, and then Frederick had his photo taken sitting on top of the detainee. It should be mentioned that the medics advised this treatment of putting the mentally unstable detainee strapped between two litters to keep him from harming himself. It was not Frederick's idea, but rather following medical protocol. Assault consummated by battery. Frederick once punched a detainee in the chest with enough force to cause the detainee to have difficulty breathing. Stipulation of fact, page 8. This detainee was one of the rioters brought to Tier 1A after their attempted escape and battery against a female MP at Camp Gansey. Indecent acts with another. This refers to the accused forcing several detainees to masturbate in front of male and female soldiers and other detainees while they were being photographed. Under the circumstances, the conduct of the accused was of a nature to bring discredit upon the armed forces and was prejudicial to good order and discipline. The stipulation goes on. These photographs and other images captured by the accused and his co-conspirators were taken for personal reasons. The images were saved on personal computers and not for official purposes. Stipulation of fact, page 9. The trial. Frederick's trial was held in Baghdad on October 20th and 21st, 2004, despite the defense counsel's motion for a change of venue to the United States. Since I refused to go to such a dangerous place, I went instead to the naval base in Naples, Italy, where I gave my testimony in a video conference in a highly secured room. It was a difficult setting because, first, my testimony was being disrupted by delayed audio feedback, and second, the images of the trial on the video screen sometimes froze. Compounding the difficulty was the fact that I was talking to a TV screen and not interacting directly with the judge. To make it even more difficult, I was told not to use notes during my testimony, which meant that I had to recall from memory the hundreds of pages of the 5 investigative reports that I had carefully read, plus all the other background information I had amassed on Frederick and the Tier 1A conditions. Given that Frederick had already entered a guilty plea, my testimony was focused entirely on specifying the situational and systemic influences on his behavior that had been induced by the impact of an abnormal setting on a very normal young man. I also outlined the psychological assessment results, the positive aspects of his background before he was assigned to Tier 1A, and highlights from my interview with him. This was done in an effort to support the conclusion that Frederick had brought no pathological tendencies into that behavioral context. Rather, I argued that the situation had brought out the aberrant behaviors in which he engaged and for which he is both sorry and guilty. I also made clear that, in trying to understand how Frederick's actions were impacted by situational social dynamics, I was engaging not in excusiology, but rather in a conceptual analysis that is not usually considered seriously enough in sentencing decisions. In addition, in giving my credentials and relevance to this case, I outlined the main features and findings and some parallels between the Stanford Prison Experiment and the environment of abuse at Abu Ghraib Prison. My full testimony appears on pages 294 to 330 of Ivan Chip Frederick's trial transcripts, October 2004. Unfortunately, it is not available online. The prosecutor, Major Michael Hawley, dismissed the thrust of my situational argument. He argued that Frederick knew right from wrong, had adequate military training for the job, and essentially had made a rational decision to engage in the immoral, detrimental behaviors with which he was charged. Thus, he put all the blame on Frederick's disposition to knowingly do evil, while pushing any situational or systemic influences out of consideration by the court. He also implied that the Geneva Conventions was, in effect, and that these soldiers should have known its constraints. That is not true, as we will see in the next chapter. President George Bush and his legal advisors changed the definition of these detainees and of torture in a set of legal memos that rendered the Geneva Conventions obsolete during this war on terror. The verdict. The military judge, Colonel James Pohl, took only 1 hour to return his verdict of guilty as charged on all counts. Frederick's prison sentence was set at 8 years. My testimony apparently had a minimal effect on the severity of his sentence, as did the eloquent plea of his attorney, Gary Myers. All of the situational and systemic factors that I detailed were worth little on the international public relations stage that had been established by the military and the Bush administration chains of command. They had to show the world and the Iraqi people that they were tough on crime and would swiftly punish these few rogue soldiers, the bad apples in the otherwise good U.S. Army barrel. Once all of them had been tried, sentenced, and jailed, only then might this stain on the American military fade away. Charles Grainer refused to plead guilty and got a 10-year sentence. Lindy England, in a complicated series of trials, was sentenced to 3 years in prison. Jeremy Sivitz got 1 year, while Javal Davis got 6 months. Sabrina Harmon got off with a light sentence of 6 months based on evidence of her prior kindness to Iraqis before she was assigned to Abu Ghraib. Finally, Megan Ambuhl was discharged without any prison time. Some relevant comparisons. There is no question that the abuses engaged in by Chip Frederick brought physical and emotional suffering to prisoners under his charge and enduring humiliation and anger to their families. He pled guilty, was found guilty as charged, and given a stern sentence. From the Iraqis' perspective, it was too lenient. From my perspective, it was too severe, given the circumstances that had precipitated and sustained the abuses. However, it is instructive to compare his sentence to that of another soldier in another war who was found guilty of capital offenses against civilians. One of the earlier stains on the pride of the U.S. military came during the Vietnam War, when soldiers in Charlie Company invaded the village of My Lai in search of Viet Cong fighters. None were found there, but the chronic stresses, frustrations, and fears of these soldiers erupted in unimaginable fury against the local civilians. More than 500 Vietnamese women, children, and elderly people were murdered in close-up machine gun barrages or burned alive in their huts, and many women were raped and disemboweled. Some of them were even scalped. Terrifying descriptions of these cruelties were voiced in a matter-of-fact way by some of the soldiers in the film Interviews with My Lai Vets. Seymour Hersh provided a detailed account of the atrocities in his book My Lai 4, which publicly exposed them for the first time a year later. Only one soldier was found guilty for these crimes, Lieutenant William Calley, Jr. His senior officer, Captain Ernest Medina, who was on site during this search-and-destroy mission and reported to be personally firing at the civilians, was acquitted of all charges, and he resigned from service. Captain Medina, nicknamed Mad Dog, had been really proud of his men in Charlie Company, claiming, "We'd become the best company in the battalion." Perhaps this was a premature rush to judgment. Lieutenant Kelly was found guilty of the premeditated murder of more than 100 Vietnamese civilians at My Lai. His original life sentence was reduced to 3.5 years, which he served in the barracks under house arrest, never spending a day in prison. Most people don't know that he subsequently received a pardon for these mass murders and returned to his community to become a paid after-dinner speaker and honored businessman. Might it have been different if Callie had been just an enlisted man and not an officer? Might it have also been different if trophy photos had been taken by the soldiers of Charlie Company that would have made vivid and real what words about such brutal atrocities failed to convey? I think so. Another set of relevant comparisons comes from lining up some of the night shift MPs against other soldiers who have been recently charged and sentenced by military courts for various crimes. It becomes apparent that though convicted for similar or even worse crimes, the sentences handed down to these other soldiers were much more lenient. Staff Sergeant Frederick's maximum sentence for his crimes was 10 years in prison, dishonorable discharge, DD, and reduction to the lowest rank, E1. With his plea bargain, he received 8 years in prison, DD, demotion to E1, and forfeiture of all pay and allowances, including 22 years of his saved retirement income. Corporal Berg was found guilty of negligent homicide, self-injury, and false statements. Maximum sentence, 11 years in prison. Received, 18 months and E1. Sergeant First Class Price was found guilty of assault, maltreatment, and obstruction of justice. Maximum sentence, 8 years in prison, DD and E1. Received, reduction in rank to SSG, no prison time, no DD. Corporal Grainer was found guilty of assault, maltreatment, nonverbal conspiracy, indecent acts, and dereliction of duty. Maximum sentence, 15 years in prison, DD and E1. Received, 10 years in prison, DD, E1, and a fine. Private Brand was found guilty of assault, maltreatment, false swearing, and maiming. Maximum sentence, 16 years in prison, DD, and E1. Received, only reduction in rank to E1. Sergeant, name withheld, was found guilty of assault, unlawful discharge of firearm, robbery, and dereliction of duty. Maximum sentence, 24.5 years in prison, DD and E1. Received, only a letter of reprimand. Private England was found guilty of conspiracy, maltreatment, and indecent act. Maximum sentence, 10 years in prison, DD and E1. Received, 3 years in prison. Sergeant First Class Perkins was found guilty of aggravated assault, assault and battery, and obstruction of justice. Maximum sentence, 11.5 years in prison, DD and E1. Received 6 months in prison and reduction in rank to Staff Sergeant. Captain Martin was found guilty of aggravated assault, assault, obstruction of justice, and conduct unbecoming of an officer. Maximum sentence, 9 years in prison. Received 45 days in prison. Clearly, then, the scales of military justice were not evenly balanced for these comparable crimes. I believe it was the trophy photos that added considerable weight to bias the legal decisions against the night shift MPs. For a fuller set of such comparisons and a listing of 60 soldiers who have been court-martialed and their dispositions, as well as other clarifications to the record on the Abu Ghraib abuses, please see the interesting website www.supportmpscapegoats.com. The transformation of prison guard Ivan Frederick into prisoner number 789689. Our focus in attempting to describe the Lucifer effect has been on understanding transformations of human character. Perhaps one of the most extreme and rare transformations imaginable takes place in someone going from a position of power as a prison guard to a position of total powerlessness as a prisoner. That is sadly so in the case of this once fine corrections officer, dedicated soldier, and loving husband. He has been battered and nearly broken by the verdict against him from the military court and his subsequent cruel treatment in confinement. Chip Frederick is now reduced to a number, 789689, as an inmate on Warehouse Road in the U.S. Disciplinary Barracks at Fort Leavenworth. After being sentenced in Baghdad, Chip was shipped off to Kuwait, where he was put in solitary confinement, even though he posed no danger to himself or others. He describes conditions there as being reminiscent of his tears at Abu Ghraib, But his situation got worse when he was imprisoned at Fort Leavenworth. Chip had been given medications for the insomnia, depression, and anxiety attacks that he suffered in the years since the scandal broke. However, in the Kansas prison, he was denied all meds, forced to go cold turkey. That meant not sleeping and being under constant stress. "I don't think I can do it. I don't think that I can take it anymore," he wrote to me on Christmas 2004. He was put in a small, cold cell, given only 2 thin blankets and no pillow, and forced to wear dirty, worn socks and underwear with fecal and urine stains. His subhuman treatment was extended when he went to Texas for the trial of a fellow MP. The military publicly stripped his uniform of 9 honor medals and ribbons he had won over 20 years of military service while he watched in tears. Moreover, to rub salt into his wounds, he was brought in front of the courthouse so that the media could see him in his shackles. He is reminded daily that you do not do things that humiliate the U.S. Army without suffering payback. Now that all the trials of the Abu Ghraib 7 are over, Chip Frederick's treatment has improved. He's going to barber school in the prison to learn a new trade because he can never serve as a corrections officer again. "I would love to be reinstated back into the Army to go back over there and prove myself. I was the one to never give up on anything, and that it was me that could make a difference. I was very prepared to die for my country, my family, and my friends. I wanted to be the one to make a difference. I am proud that I served much of my adult life for my country." Do you see the parallel with Stew 819, the SPE prisoner who insisted on going back into our prison to show his mates that he was not a bad prisoner? It is also reminiscent of a classic social psychological experiment that showed greater loyalty to one's group the more severe was the initiation into it. Martha Frederick's life has also been shattered by these trials and tribulations. You may recall that she is a corrections officer in the Pennsylvania prison where they met. "Abu Iraq is the pit of inhumanity, and Abu has become the graveyard where my life as I know it was laid to rest, Uncle Phil. Normal life as I once knew it will never be again. Life has become a constant struggle to rise above the rubble of that place financially and mentally." Another side effect of this sad story is Martha's recent decision to divorce Chip because of the financial and emotional burdens she has had to endure. The decision has been yet another devastating blow to him. However, she remains steadfast in her support of him. She wrote me, "I have stood beside him, in front of him, and behind him through all that has occurred, and I will continue to do so, even separate from the bonds of marriage. But I just can't go on living in this vacuum." Finally, there is another sad answer to the question of whether the abusive interrogations were worth it. Did they yield the actionable intelligence being sought by the military and civilian command? Perhaps, but no, not likely. Maybe a bit, but hardly worth justifying the irrefutable damage to America's moral image, or the suffering of those interrogated and the lasting psychological impact on the interrogators. Of course, administration sources will say that they did get what they were looking for, but it is classified, so they can never tell us how much the coercive interrogations helped in their war on terror and secondary war on insurgents. They are not immune to lying to cover their tracks. However, most experts on torture and on police interrogations agree that such physical abuse committed with humiliating and degrading tactics rarely yields trustworthy evidence. You get confessions and admissions by building rapport, not by bullying, by earning trust, not by fostering hatred. We have seen earlier the negative reactions of some of the soldiers who participated in these military interrogations. Too many innocents were detained who had no useful information to offer. Too few trained interrogators, fewer trained translators, and too great a demand from top down to get information immediately, no questions asked. Political scientist and torture expert Darius Rajali has gone on record doubting the reliability of such interrogation procedures used throughout military bases in Iraq, Gitmo, and Afghanistan. He contends there is a consensus that people will say anything under conditions of physical coercion. You will find statements to this effect from official U.S. government documents, including the U.S. Army Field Manual for Interrogation, FM 30-15, the CIA Kubark Manual, 1963, and the Human Resources Exploitation Manual, 1985. In one of his essays on Salon.com, Rajali asserts that torture may have a dark allure, giving the interrogator a drug-like rush while immersed in the process, but leaving a legacy of destruction that takes generations to undo. Final notes. In the next chapter, we will move from our focus on individual soldiers caught up in an inhuman behavioral setting to consider the role that the system played in creating the conditions that fostered the abuses and tortures at Abu Ghraib and in many other military prisons. There we will examine the complexities of systemic influences that operated to create and sustain a culture of abuse. First, we will review highlights of the many independent military investigations into these abuses. That will allow us to measure the extent to which those investigations implicate system variables, such as leadership failures, little or no mission-specific training, inadequate resources, and interrogation-confession priorities, as major contributors to what occurred on that night shift in Abu Ghraib. Then we will examine reports from Human Rights Watch of other comparable, and some even worse, abuses reported by officers in the Army's elite 82nd Airborne Division in Iraq. We will broaden our search to investigate the ways in which military and government chains of command created similar situations in other military prisons to facilitate their war on terrorism and war on insurgency. We will do so with the help of interviews and analyses reported in a PBS Frontline documentary, A Question of Torture, October 18, 2005, which details the role of the Bush administration and the military's chain of command in first sanctioning such torture in Guantanamo Bay Prison and then transporting it to Abu Ghraib and beyond. I will shift roles from behavioral scientist turned psychological investigative reporter in the current chapter to that of prosecutor in the next. I will charge selected members of the military chain of command with misusing their authority to make torture operational at Guantanamo Bay Prison and then exporting those tactics to Abu Ghraib. They gave permission to the military police and military intelligence to employ these torture tactics under sanitized terms, and failed to provide the leadership, oversight, accountability, and mission-specific training necessary for the MPs on the night shift on Tier 1A. I will argue that they are thus guilty of sins of both commission and omission. In putting the system on hypothetical trial, we end up by putting President Bush and his advisors in the dock for their role in redefining torture as an acceptable, necessary tactic in their ubiquitous and nebulous war on terror. They are also charged with exempting captured insurgents and all foreigners under military arrest from the safeguards provided by the Geneva Conventions. Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld is charged with creating the interrogation centers where detainees were subjected to a host of extremely coercive abuses for the dubious purpose of eliciting confessions and information. He is probably also responsible for other violations of American moral standards, such as outsourcing the torture of high-value detainees to foreign countries in the government's extraordinary rendition program. I intend to show that the system, from Bush to Cheney to Rumsfeld and down the hierarchy of command, laid the foundation for these abuses. If so, then we, as a democratic society, have much to do to ensure that future abuses are prevented by insisting that the system modify the structural features and operational policies of its interrogation centers. We will end the next chapter on an upbeat note, because, in fact, a plan was put into place at Abu Ghraib to better train MPs, MI personnel, and interrogators in the exercise of their power. My psychologist colleague, Colonel Larry James, was sent to that prison recently, May 2004, to install a new set of operational procedures intended to deter the kind of violence we've examined in this chapter. Of special interest is the provision that all MPs and other relevant personnel view the DVD of the Stanford Prison Experiment as part of their training. How that came about and what effects it is having will be part of the good news to come out of this bad news place. That positive outlook will then carry us into the final chapter. There I will try to balance some of the negativity with which we have been dealing in our long journey by offering two encouraging perspectives on learning ways to resist unwanted influences and on celebrating heroes and heroism. Finally, I recognize that it may seem a stretch to some readers that I emphasize parallels between our little Stanford experiment in a simulated prison and the dangerous realities of a combat zone prison. It is not the physical dissimilarities that matter, but the basic psychological dynamics that are comparable in both. I would point out further that several independent investigators have made such comparisons, as in the Schlesinger report, quoted at the start of this chapter, and in a report by former naval cryptologist Alan Hensley. In his analysis of the defendants charged with the abuses, he concluded, "In the case of Abu Ghraib, a model described in detail in the Zimbardo study constructed of virtually identical factors and resulting empirical evidence existed beforehand to predict with utmost certainty this chain of events would occur without conscious deliberation on the part of the participants." I want to end this phase of our journey with the analysis of Newsweek magazine's Baghdad bureau chief, Ron Nordland, about what he thinks went wrong in a war that began with good intentions. What went wrong? A lot, but the biggest turning point was the Abu Ghraib scandal. Since April 2004, the liberation of Iraq has become a desperate exercise in damage control. The abuse of prisoners at Abu Ghraib alienated a broad swath of the Iraqi public. On top of that, it didn't work. There is no evidence that all the mistreatment and humiliation saved a single American life or led to the capture of any major terrorist, despite claims by the military that the prison produced actionable intelligence.